I mean, every case is hard, but we've been lucky that we've walked 38 people out of prison. One case I worked on for 27 years, my first innocence case, I finished this past October. I started it when I was 29 years old. I finished it at 57. I finally got her fully exonerated, and she'd been sentenced to death and was innocent. Something like 17% of wrongful convictions are the result of false confessions. We know that half the wrongful convictions are bad identifications. We know that misconduct by police and government actors is something like 12 or 13% of cases. Honestly, most of the wrongful convictions don't happen due to people intentionally trying to set people up. It's just due to bad work, sloppy work, mistakes that are made, poor interrogation techniques, bad identification techniques.
Very good, good stuff. Thank you very much for joining me, Justin. For anyone who doesn't know, can you give us like a quick idea of your background and what your upcoming book is about?
Sure. My name's Justin Brooks. I'm director of the California Innocence Project, which is a law school clinic where we investigate cases of innocent people in prison. And when we find good cases, we litigate them and we get them out. I've been fortunate to walk 38 innocent people out of prison. And I've just recently written a book called You Might Go to Prison, Even Though You're Innocent, which is available now on Amazon and other sites. And the book is kind of a summation of what I've learned in the last 32 years working in the criminal justice system about why innocent people go to prison. And it's sort of a cautionary tale, I think, for readers that it really could happen to anyone.
Interesting. Okay, so we'll get into it. How do false convictions generally come about, if there is like an average way that it happens, or a typical way?
Sure. Well, so my book breaks it down into 10 categories of different reasons I've seen why innocent people go to prison. The first chapter starts with, you know, you got the wrong lawyer. There's a lot of mistakes people make in choosing lawyers. There's a lot of misperceptions where people think public defenders aren't good lawyers, so I want to always get a private lawyer. Whereas public defenders often have experience, training, supervision, and most importantly, in innocence cases, investigators. And oftentimes with private lawyers, they don't pay to have an investigator. They don't check out the innocence claim. And so of the 38 people I've walked out of prison, only two were represented by public defenders, and the other 36 were represented by private lawyers. So I think that's kind of a misconception that I break down in the book. I talk about how people get wrongfully convicted based on false confessions and how that happens. And the leading cause of wrongful conviction I spend a lot of time talking about is bad identifications, which sort of just starts with that people's memories aren't very good. But when they come in court and they say, I'm 100% sure that's the person who did it, that's enough to get you convicted. So we've been working around the country and around the world, really, to change identification procedures that the police use, because often those procedures lead to misidentifications. So there's a lot of topics in the book. I get into bad sciences that have led to wrongful convictions. I get into race issues that lead to wrongful convictions, and all the causes.
Interesting. On that note, I have read before that apparently eyewitness testimony, even though it seems very clear and objective and everything, it's actually one of the worst kinds, apparently, because especially in stressful situations, when you go back and piece together the memory of what happened then, your mind will like fill in things that weren't quite there, or will rearrange, or will get the time perception way wrong.
So it's exactly as you describe it. Memory is a reconstructive process, right? We don't go around all day and record everything we see and then play it back. We store bits of information that are stored through our five senses. So memory also isn't just visual. It's visual, it's audio, it's based on smell, it's based on touch. And all those things are put in different parts of our brain as we're storing a memory. And then when you want to pull a memory back, it's a reconstructive process. And the problem with that is it can be reconstructed incorrectly, often based on suggestion. So for instance, we've been trying to get rid of six-pack photo arrays, and we finally got rid of them in California. We've been fighting around the world about this topic. studies have shown that when people look at six photos next to each other, what happens in their brains is they lock on whoever looks most like the suspect in their head, and those other photos kind of lead them down this path of getting more and more confident that that is the person because it looks most like the person comparatively. We also know that if the procedure is not double blind, meaning neither the witness nor the police officer conducting the procedure can know who the fillers are and can know who the suspect is, because the police officers often tip off the witnesses. They'll do silly little tells because they're not good poker players. Or sometimes what will happen is the witness will say, well, kind of looks like number three. And then the officer will say, good job. And now by the time that witness comes to court and is in front of the jury, they're saying, I'm 100% sure it's that guy. And they were never 100% sure. It's just the officer made them sure after confirming to them that they picked the person that the officer thought it was. There's a million ways these things go wrong. And I'll tell you another one that's very common in California is cross-racial identifications are some of the worst identifications. And it's just fundamentally that people aren't good at identifying people not of their own race, particularly if they don't have a lot of experience with that race. And what happens is basically in the first 4 years of your life, you learn 80% of what you learn. And one of those things you learn is how to recognize faces. And it's sort of, I have a 2-year-old grandson right now, and I'm kind of watching him go through these processes. But right away, you know who your mom is because through smell and hearing, and you've been so connected for so long that you right away have that connection with your mother. But then a baby is trying to figure out who everybody else is, kind of one by one. And they're developing this facial recognition software that where they can look at your eyes, your nose, your mouth, and go, okay, that's dad. Okay, that's my uncle. That's my grandmother. And if everyone around you is white, for the rest of your life, you will not be good at identifying non-white people. It's a scientific fact. And we're not comfortable ever talking about race, so we don't talk to juries about this. But it's terrible. It's even worse, by the way. I work in Latin America a lot. And in Latin America, for instance, in Mexico, where I work, the inability of most Mexicans to identify any Asian people and to distinguish between a Chinese person, a Japanese person, a Thai person is incredible. It's like they literally do not have in a lot, most cities in Mexico any exposure to Asian people. And so they're absolutely terrible at it. And it's just
I'm
something.
sorry to interrupt you. Does this apply evenly throughout the races?
Well, that's an interesting point because there was one study that I saw that said Black Americans are better at identifying white Americans than white Americans are Black Americans because you can't grow up in America without being exposed to a lot of white people, but you can grow up in America and not be exposed to a lot of people of color. And again, it just comes, it's nothing to do with racism. It's just purely due to exposure. So for example, I went to high school in Puerto Rico. I was actually the only gringo in my high school. And so I'm pretty good at identifying Puerto Ricans because they don't all look the same to me because I've been exposed to, millions of Puerto Ricans, but I'm still not as good as a Puerto Rican or someone who as a baby was developing the fine-tuned distinctions between the size of people's eyes and their nose and their mouth. And by race, that stuff is very different. It's incredibly subtle. It's so subtle that you can't explain it, but it's just something that's going on in your brain as you're doing that. Every day you think about it, we walk around, we're identifying billions of items in front of us. And our brains had to develop the software to be able to do that, to figure out distance, to figure out, how to control gravity when you're walking, which is basically a process of, going against the gravitational pull of the earth. And that this is what babies are learning how to do. And I've walked six people out of prison who were convicted on cross-racial IDs, and I have no confidence in them. They're just all terrible.
Oh, interesting. Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, so tell me a bit about can you tell me a bit about the process of picking like prospective I suppose clients, people who you think is worth pursuing an appeal. How does that I assume it's all post-conviction, right? That they've already
Yeah,
been
it's
like
all post-conviction. And California, until recently, had the largest prison system in the United States. We're now number two to Texas because we legalized marijuana and did some other things to decrease the population. But for the past decades, we've had the largest prison population in the US, and the US has the largest prison population in the world. So we receive thousands of requests a year for assistance. I've got a team of 30 law students, 10 full-time lawyers, and about 100 volunteer lawyers who work for me. And most of our job is screening through those cases, looking for the cases where we believe we can win them. And twice a week, there's presentations in my office. I had them yesterday, where the cases get presented, and I've got the awful Caesar-like power of thumbs up or thumbs down of whether they move on in our process. But it's a sort of, it's a sort of Ford assembly line process, which is horrible to say, but the only way to process thousands of cases is we have to have a system for it. And so someone writes us a letter, they say they're innocent. We then send out a lengthy questionnaire to find out everything about their case. A law student will review that. We'll then get copies of their briefs and transcripts. Students will read through those. They'll write memos. A lawyer will then review the memo, and we'll start working the process through of whether it's a winnable case or not. Some are very obviously not winnable, and I'll give you one whole category: drug cases. I've never won a drug case in the United States, because there's only two elements to a drug case. Did you have drugs, and did you know you had drugs? So if you got pulled over in a car and your friend's backpack in the back seat has cocaine in it, and you didn't know he had cocaine, you can still be charged with possession. Now, if you go to the jury and say, it was his backpack, I didn't know it was there, and they don't believe it, I can't unring that bell because that's purely a fact decision determination made by a jury. So there's certain types of cases I know are unwinnable. The most winnable cases and the cases you see in the news all the time of people being exonerated are typically rape and murder cases, because in those cases, there's forensic evidence where you can go back and double check what happened or do testing that was never done. And that's where you can show definitive innocence. But we also have won cases where witnesses have recanted. My most famous case is the Brian Banks case. A movie was made out of it with who Greg Kinnear played me in the movie, which was an interesting experience to go through. But the Brian Banks case, it was just a 15-year-old classmate who said he raped her. And then years later, she came forward and said he didn't. And it became a massive news story because he was one of the best football players in the United States. He was on his way to play in the NFL, and he ends up going to prison instead. And fortunately, we got his conviction reversed. He ended up playing for the Atlanta Falcons for a little while in the
I'm
NFL.
sorry. In that case, the person, the lady who was, or the young lady who was supposedly, she was the one that made the, she was the one that made the claim, or another student.
Yeah, she claimed that he raped her. And then years later, she Facebook friend requested him and then sent him a message and said, can we let bygones be bygones? I'm sorry about the stuff I made up in high school about you raping me. And then she fully recanted. And then as we went into the evidence, it was all inconsistent anyway. And like I said, it became a big news story because he was one of the best football players in the country. And it was just, 15-year-old kid, and he was a kid, and his life was over. So there are some cases like that that are just based on lies that then we've got to kind of undo them. And those are very hard because, if there's no science involved, we've got to convince a judge that there was a wrongful conviction. And that's hard. I mean, every case is hard, but we've been lucky that we've walked 38 people out of prison. One case I worked on for 27 years, my first innocence case, I finished this past October. I started it when I was 29 years old. I finished it at 57 and finally got her fully exonerated, and she'd been sentenced to death and was innocent. So yeah, these cases are hard.
For the case with the football player, I know you said she the accuser took back her statement years and years later. Is there any kind of repercussions for someone who does that, and makes it that clear that like who actually says like I lied? Is there any can you be charged with a crime?
Under the law, there is perjury, But I've never seen in my cases anyone prosecuted for perjury except that woman that you're referring to. And the reason it was because not only did she lie about him raping her, while she was in prison, her family filed a lawsuit against the school where she claimed it happened, and they got $1.5 million settlement from the school district for failure to protect her at school. And when it was all discovered to be false, they sued her for the money back. They went after her for perjury, and she's disappeared now. No one knows where she is. So, yeah, there is repercussions, but almost never does anything happen.
Right. Okay. When we think, people generally, when you think of like false convictions being overturned, I think the most common one that pops to people's head is a murder. You know, where you have your life imprisonment, or depending on the state, you might have possibility of a death penalty. I interviewed a gentleman. You probably know him. You know Marty Tankliff?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, he
I
was
just
actually one of
had
my
dinner
first.
with him last week.
Yeah, there you go. He's one of my first interviews. I interviewed him in person. For anyone who doesn't know, when he was 19, he got falsely convicted of murdering his parents and did 18 years in prison before he was freed. So okay, on that note, do you have like a rough breakdown of what percentage of your the case you take on are murder and so on?
I think more than half the cases that we ultimately take on are murder cases, I would say. And again, the reason is because there's always questions in murder cases about what really happened, and there's often forensic science that can disprove it. But yeah, Marty's case is one of the most tragic cases in the innocence world. Here he, and one of the chapters in my book is devoted to the topic of Marty's case, which was a false confession. And Marty was this kid, a high school kid, who wakes up one morning and his parents have been brutally murdered. His dad was still breathing but almost dead, and the police, to this confused high school kid, they start interrogating him, and then they do a fake phone call pretending that his dad has called, and his dad is saying that he's the one who stabbed him. And this poor kid gets so confused in this, and thinking, my dad wouldn't be saying it if I didn't do it, and maybe I blacked out, and maybe I was sleepwalking, and maybe I didn't know. And he ends up confessing in that situation and ends up going to prison for 2 decades. And Marty, since then, he's an amazing human being. He's got out. He got a law degree. He's now a lawyer in Manhattan. He's a professor. He's teaching at Georgetown. But just insane. And we just got a law passed in California that says the police cannot lie to juveniles in order to get confessions. And most people I talk to say, I would have thought that was already the law. And we actually tried to get the law for adults and couldn't get it passed. But the police can lie all day long. And people think, well, what difference does it make if they lie? If I didn't do it, I'm not going to say I did it. Well, you get people who are blackout drunk, and then they're getting interrogated, and then they interrogate them for 13, 14 hours, and they get deeply confused about reality and what happened. They'll say they've got a videotape of you doing it. They'll say they got 19 people who say you did it. They'll say they can only make a deal now. If you say it now, we can make a deal and this thing will go away. All police are trained on a thing called the Reed technique, which isn't designed at getting the truth. It's a psychological technique to get the person you're trying to get to agree with you. So you come up with a narrative in your head, and the whole focus of the Reed technique is get that person to agree to that narrative. It has nothing to do with getting the truth. It's just about getting agreement. And that's what happened to poor Marty.
Have you ever had occasions where you took on a case that you believed to be a false conviction and believed to be winnable, and it turned out during the process that it looked like you were being BS'd?
Oh yeah, for sure. Because some cases we take on, which are DNA cases, we don't know whether they're innocent or guilty. So let's say we have an old case and no one did DNA testing on it. The guy says, I'm innocent. So in that situation, it's like, I don't know if you're innocent, I don't know if you're guilty, but I know the DNA test will tell us the result. And I go out to the prison. I have a whole come to Jesus speech about, don't have me do this test if you're guilty, because if it comes back you're never getting out of here. This is going right to the parole board and you're not going to get parole. And I've couple of times people have said, okay, don't do the test. And a couple of times people have told me, do the test, and it's come back a match. One of them, I was convinced that this guy actually did believe that he hadn't done it. It was so brutal. It was a brutal murder, brutal rapes, multiple women. And I think he had some type of deep psychiatric thing going on where what he did was so bad and he buried it so deep in his brain that he didn't believe that he'd done it. Because when I told him the results, he said, oh, I guess you're just in with the government and you're setting me up now. And I was like, okay, dude, this is our last conversation, but okay, go ahead,
Okay.
pick what you think. But so it does happen. It's rare. It's very rare. So, I'm talking about 23 years, it's happened twice. But it
Fair,
can happen.
fair. I see. Okay, so when you do come across cases that you're pretty sure they were falsely convicted, even anecdotally, do you kind of have a breakdown of the ones that you think were falsely convicted due to incompetence, and ones that were like intentional, where the cops or investigators knew full well this wasn't the person, but just wanted to get someone for it.
Yeah, there's lots of statistics on that now. There's a great source called the Registry of Exonerations, which breaks down the causes of wrongful conviction into categories. So, for example, we now know that something like 17% of wrongful convictions are the result of false confessions. We know that half the wrongful convictions are bad identifications. We know that a misconduct by police and government actors is something like 12 or 13% of cases. We also, which is much harder, in fact, the hardest chapter of my book to write was the last chapter about race. Because when you look at statistics, we know that race permeates the system, but it's very hard in our modern system to directly point to race as the reason someone gets wrongfully convicted, right? Like I can say, this was a bad confession, that's why they got wrongfully convicted. This was a bad ID, that's why they got wrongfully convicted. But all the bias and prejudice that comes with race plays out in the criminal justice system. And there was a recent study where they had groups watch trials in virtual reality. And the only thing they changed trial to trial was the race of the defendant. And they found huge difference in conviction rates, in sentences that were given, directly just attributed to the race of the defendant. And we know in the wrongful conviction world that even though the United States is comprised of 17% Black people, it's close to 50% of the people who've been wrongfully convicted who are exonerated. We also know that race of the victim often drives the prosecution, particularly when you look at white women as victims. When white women are victims, it always becomes news stories. And when it becomes news stories, it becomes political. And now the prosecutors like to step into the limelight of those news stories. And we see more wrongful convictions due to rushes to prosecute in those cases. And we see greater sentences in those cases as a result. So that's one of the things I talk about in my book as I go through kind of the history in the US of overt racism in the criminal justice system with Jim Crow laws and just laws that are blatantly discriminatory. Now, the problem is the laws themselves are not blatantly discriminatory, but it's still just people going into buildings every day to apply these laws in court, and people are still biased and racist. And so we see it having that kind of impact on the system. But yet, and now that we've now documented more than 3,000 cases of wrongful conviction in the United States, there's a lot of statistics that show, why it happens.
I'd have to imagine that for the humans that make up the justice system, there are some incentives to just get a conviction, whether you're kind of sure or not, be it like a homicide detective or a prosecutor or something like that. Have you found that to be the case, that there's
Oh,
kind of
yeah.
perverse incentives that exist?
Well, let's start with the fact that 95% of cases are pled out in the United States. We've created
95.
a 95%. Only 5% of cases even go to trial. And so that whole system has been set up to get to a conviction quickly. And that situation has gotten worse and worse in the 32 years I've been practicing. Because when I first got out of law school, you'd be looking at a deal where a DA would say, look, if you take this deal, you might get a 6 to 8. If you don't take it, you're looking at a 10 to 12, right? It was like, it wasn't as dramatic as we see now. For instance, in the Brian Banks case where he took a plea, day of trial, his lawyer said, if you plead out to this case, I think I can get you probation. If you don't, and we go into court, you're looking at 44 years to life. So now when you're looking at those choices, it doesn't even matter whether you did it or not at this point. It's just like, am I going to accept this level of risk? So when I'm first practicing law, if I'm talking to a client who's innocent and I say 6 to 8, for the deal, 10 to 12, if you go to trial, if we win the trial, zero, they're going, let's try this thing. Because I think I can win and I'm innocent and I'm not going to take the 6 more years in prison. But when you're sitting there looking at, I'm going to die in prison if we lose this, and I might go home today if I take this deal, now you're pleading out even if you're innocent. And so the whole system is geared towards resolution. The judges are involved in it, the prosecutors are involved in it, the defense attorneys are involved in it, the police are involved in it. And it's because when you're running the largest prison system, the largest criminal justice system in the world, which is what we have here in the United States, it starts operating like a factory. It's no longer handmade. When you have a small system, you pay attention to details. You look at each case individually. I've used the example before. I say, like, if you're doing handmade furniture and then people really like your chairs, and then one day you go, we can't make it by hand anymore. We start making it in a factory. You start making mistakes. That's what's happened in our criminal justice system. It's just become too big, too out of control. And so there's not enough attention to detail. And everybody is complicit in this that's in the system because it's all about moving the cases forward.
See, on the given how risky it can be, excuse me, given how risky it can be to speak to police at all, even if you're brought in for a suspect in a murder, absolutely nothing to do with you've got no knowledge at all. I've heard like a few lawyers like on YouTube and stuff, saying that you should just as a rule you should just never speak to police at all. Just tell them you want your lawyer. I'm not saying anything else. Is that something that you would advise, like even if
Yeah,
like someone asked you at dinner?
there's no benefit whatsoever to talking to the police during an interrogation. There's none. There's only downside. They have no power to make any deals, no matter what they say to you. It'll be up to the district attorney that looks at the case the next day. It won't be up to the police to make a deal. So they can lie to you all day about that they've got the power, but they don't. Here, if you get pulled over in your car, a police officer asks you a question. The benefit of answering that question could be convenience of like, I want to get out of here and I'm not really doing anything wrong. So I understand people talking to the police in a casual situation like that. But if you've already been taken into custody, there's never a reason to talk to the police without your lawyer present. There's no reason to talk to them at all, in fact. What ben no benefit can come from it, only downside. And you're already in custody anyway. You're not going anywhere. So you might as well cool your heels in the jail. And also, by the way, don't talk to anyone in the jail because in the United States, it is perfectly legal for the police to be undercover in the jail talking to people or have agents in there talking to people or record your telephone conversations. I can't tell you how many cases I look at. In fact, we won a case because this guy in jail called his girlfriend and said, I don't know who this dude is who's going down for this murder that I did, but I'm the one who did it. And he thought it was funny. And then we were able to use that to get our guy exonerated because he basically confessed to his girlfriend. You see people confessing to their family members all the time where they've audio taped the room. You have no expectation of privacy in a jail cell or anywhere in a correctional facility. And so they just record all that. And so, yeah, it's always the best route to say nothing and let your lawyer do the work for you.
So let's say I'll give you a scenario. You're examining a case. It came about a conviction came about from a confession. You dig into it. You see it to be forced and to be like not above board at all. Even if it was even if like years have passed, you okay, sorry, you get your guy, you get your guy off. Is there then any, is there any blowback then for the police who acted who acted out outside of the law? Can you even like pass the details on to someone who does that?
Almost never. Some people get lawsuits that they can file and are successful, but first of all, prosecutors have total immunity, judges have total immunity, and police officers have near total immunity. So unless you've got real proof that the behavior was outrageous, the George Floyd type cases where you got a video of an officer with a knee on someone's throat that dies. Those cases that have solid evidence that they can really establish, not that mistakes were made, but that intentional bad actions were done, then you can have a lawsuit. But it's only a fraction of people who've been wrongfully convicted that are successful in lawsuits. It's extraordinarily rare that there's ever any discipline against police officers or prosecutors. That's why in California, we got a law passed that now our clients get $150 a day for every day they're wrongfully incarcerated, regardless of whether they can file a lawsuit or not. It just comes out of a state compensation fund. And so my clients that have done 20 years, get $1 million. And it doesn't make them whole because they have the rest of their life of psychological issues and the prior 20 years of just being tortured. But it helps get them on their feet and get some of their life back.
On that note, have you ever come across? I know you said prosecutors and judges are pretty much immune. They are immune. But have you come across cases where, even kind of reading between the lines, it looks like a judge and or prosecutor, was being dishonest and knew that they were, that they were convicting someone falsely?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you'd asked me this question 30 years ago when I was a young lawyer, I probably would have been very like, they're all out to get my guys and they're all terrible. And as I get older, I realize that's not true, that most people get up every day and try to do the best they can and do their job. But life is a bell curve and it applies to lawyers and police and plumbers. It's like there's these few people who are extraordinary at what they do. There's most of us that fall in the good to okay, and then there's the horrible and the terrible. And, unfortunately, I work a lot with the horrible and the terrible. But so you get the crazy cases where, in Los Angeles, we had this scandal where a portion of the police department actually created their own gang and they were buying drugs, selling weapons, setting people up. And one of them got caught stealing 7 pounds of cocaine from the lockup. And then he turned on his buddy and they started all turning on each other. And they realized it was an actual gang operating within the police force. So you do have crazy stuff like that's happening. You have crazy judges every once in a while. There was a judge in Pennsylvania who was getting paid by this private prison for every person he sent there. I mean, you get
What
crazy
I'm
things
sorry,
like that.
was that a youth prison? I think I heard of
Yeah,
that
it was
one.
a
Yeah,
juvenile
I've heard of that.
detention facility for everyone he locked up. So you get every once in a while, the really like crazy, psychotic, totally corrupt individuals. But honestly, most of the wrongful convictions don't happen due to people intentionally trying to set people up. It's just due to bad work, sloppy work, mistakes that are made, poor interrogation techniques, bad identification techniques. I had a case a few years ago where this police officer did these photo arrays, and no one in the photo array matched the description given by these bank tellers in the bank that was robbed. And the whole time I'm preparing for trial, I'm like, this dude just tried to set my client up because he puts him in the photo array. He's the only one who matches the description. And I start crossing this cop really aggressively in court. I realized about halfway through my cross that he didn't do it intentionally at all. He just had no idea what he was doing. And then he walks over to me at counsel table afterwards and says, and I just had beaten him up for an hour on the stand. And he said, if your guy's innocent, I really hope you win. I'm really sorry. I wasn't trained on how to do these and I wasn't trying to, set him up. And I do believe that he was being honest about that. He was just poorly trained. And so that's that, it's like usually what's most obvious is what's right. And that's why I don't buy into a lot of conspiracy theories and things like that. I think it's just life. And then I think when I work with prosecutors after there's a conviction, it's just human nature and egos not to want to believe that they wrongfully convicted someone. So there's a whole psychological war between me and those prosecutors. I used to not be very good at it. I would just be very aggressive with them. Like, look at the facts. You obviously screwed this up. And now I say things like, look, it's not your fault. You went with the case you had. But look, here's what we have now. We got to sit down and consider this new evidence. And I get a lot more cooperation from DAs now. We often go into court together and get people out on joint motions. But yeah, there is the horrible and awful still out there.
I'd have to, you kind of touched on it briefly, but I'd have to imagine that, like, even if you were a homicide detective and you'd done a couple of weeks worth of investigation into a particular suspect who you were pretty sure it was, and then you started seeing evidence that maybe made you doubt it, then you're in a position where, oh, I just wasted a couple of weeks, and it's kind of I'm incentivized to lean towards me being right and me not having wasted all that time. Yeah, there's a lot.
And it's more subtle than that too, because the way you're describing is sort of like whether they see this other evidence, then intentionally go, well, I know I'm wrong, but I'm going to keep going down this path. Well, that's the real evil one that would do that. But what's much more common is they just kind of don't see that evidence in the light that they should see it based on their own bias and own blinders on about who they think is guilty. And that's why you often see police officers missing things on crime scenes that are inconsistent with their theory. I'll give you an example of that from one of my cases. My client, Horace Roberts, got convicted of murdering a woman he was having an affair with, and he spent 20 years in prison. And the reason they suspected him was two things. Number one, when they went to ask him about her, he lied about them having an affair because they worked together and he was married and he didn't want it all to blow up. So he's a liar. You know, and now that gets extrapolated of you lied about an affair, so you're lying about a murder. And the second thing was his truck was found by the side of the highway right near where her body was found. Because the police had locked in on thinking he was guilty, they argued that that truck was evidence of his guilt. But when I looked at it, I was like, wait a minute, the truck is fully operable. He kills her, leaves her on the side of the highway, and then walks away and leaves his truck there. And he's walking up a highway in the middle of the night. That makes no sense. So for me, the truck was actually evidence of his innocence. And of course, that's what ends up happening. He had lent her the truck. They were having an affair. And of course, the most obvious suspect is the husband. The husband who finds out about the affair kills her, puts her in the truck, drives her to the scene with a couple of buddies, dumps the body, leaves his truck there, and then drives away. But the police just didn't see it that way because they had blinders on based on their own predisposition that they thought our client was guilty. And I think that's what happens more often, is they don't have a good perspective on it based on presumptions they've made early on.
Okay. Okay. So let me, a particular person goes through like the filtration system that you have in order to take a client on. How difficult, what criteria do you have to fulfill to actually get like an official kind of appeal process going? Is it difficult?
Great question. So California, until a few years ago, had the hardest standard in the nation to get a case reopened. And I was preaching about it nonstop. I'd say, like, you know, Alabama's got a better standard. Texas has a better standard. Our standard was you had to have evidence that completely undermined the prosecution's case and pointed unerringly to innocence. So basically, unless you could blow the entire case out, every aspect of the case, no matter how strong your evidence of innocence was, you weren't going to win. And that's why we mostly only won in DNA cases and science cases where it was just definitive. Now the standard in California is similar to the rest of the country, where it is, had the jury considered this evidence, they wouldn't have convicted your client. And that's what the standard should be, is that if we're going to reverse a conviction that's based on someone was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, and I can come in with evidence that a jury would have never made that finding, then that should be a grounds for reversal. And that's what our new evidence standard is like now in California. And that's pretty much the standard. I wrote a law review article looking at every one of them in the country, so I'm very familiar with them. And they're all very similar in the light of, you just look like, would this person have been convicted?
Okay. So before you pretty much had to prove, it sounds to me almost beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Worse than that, it was like I'll give you an example. We had this case, Joanne Parks, where we had all this evidence that her house fire was accidentally started and all the science to prove that. But there was one neighbor who said, well, she didn't smell of smoke, so I don't know if she went in the house to try rescue her kids. Well, that one little piece of evidence that's incredibly flimsy and ridiculous to start with. You're standing in front of a house fire. She didn't smell of smoke. I mean, how do you know she didn't smell of smoke? But you can have just one piece of evidence that, like, how do I undermine that? And even if you have this great case, you're like, well, you didn't deal with that one witness who said she didn't smell of smoke. That's how bad the standard was. Now, some judges didn't apply it that way, but others did. And they would say, like, unless you've knocked out every piece of evidence introduced in the trial, it's not enough. And like for instance, look at the Central Park jogger case. There's a case where those five kids get convicted of raping and beating this woman in Central Park. And then years later, semen on her sock match a guy who's incarcerated, who ultimately find out he's the guy who committed this rape and murder. Well, in that case, I remember the prosecutors talking about, well, we still don't know if they were involved. Now, there's no evidence of that, literally nothing to say that. And you got DNA from a guy that's semen that's on this woman's sock. There's no other way of explaining how that happens. But still, in California, they might have looked at it and went, I don't know if you've really taken out the whole case here. I still think there could be something to this. They were in the park that night, weren't they? You know, something as flimsy as that. The mere fact of being there might be enough.
Is there kind of like an average time? You said that one of them, like you've been at it like 27 years, but is there like an average time for convictions to get overturned? Or does it vary according to the severity of the crime?
It varies mostly due to cooperation. When I get cooperation on a case with a district attorney, we can usually get someone out in a couple of years. If we don't get cooperation, it's going to be anywhere from 5 to 10 years for sure, just with going through the litigation and everything that comes with. It's very difficult to resolve a case within 2 or 3 years with that. And like I said, I've had a whole bunch that are 20 years. So I don't know what the average is. My longest serving client, well, my longest case that I worked on was 27 years. My client who served the most time was my client, Mike Canline, who spent 36 years in prison. It was factually innocent. And we worked on that case about 15 years to get him out.
What was his conviction?
Totally fabricated case by everybody involved in it. It was a murder case. His first letter to me said, I didn't do this, but this lawyer did it. And I thought, okay, crazy stuff, guys writing letters from prison. But I just so happened a friend of mine worked for that lawyer in law school. So I called the lawyer up and said, I got this crazy letter from a guy who says your old boss did this murder. And my friend says, oh yeah, I could definitely see that. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, he was dealing cocaine out of the office. He was running the gang members. He was totally out of control. That's why I quit. And then as we dug deeper and deeper, we found out that either this lawyer did the murder or hired someone to do the murder. And there was all kinds of corruption involved in it and bribes and lying. And it took us years and years. It took us years, first of all, just get the record open because it had been sealed. And then it took years longer for us to litigate it and bring the witnesses back in and exonerate him. But he spent 36 years in prison. In fact, your listeners can watch a video called Man Eats Hamburger After 36 Years on YouTube that has millions of views of me taking my client to a fast food place called Carl's Jr. to have a burger on the day he got out of prison. It's super tragic. And we're with his wife who waited all that time. They'd been married 38 years. They'd been married 2 years before he went to prison and stayed together the whole way through it.
Jeez, that is crazy. Actually, on that note, one of the things I asked Marty was like what was the biggest things that kind of hit you when you got free, you know? And he said one of them was he would go to the supermarket and he would stand in the aisles and there would be like a million types of cereal, whereas in prison there's like one or two and you're you should be happy to get them. Okay, so on that
Yeah.
note,
And they struggle with choices, by the way. I'm sure what Marty was telling you about is all my clients struggle with choices. They stand in, I had a client call me from a supermarket having a panic attack because he couldn't choose toothpaste. And it's just that's a serious issue, because that is what happens when we put people in prison. We make them less functional in regular society, and we need to think about that if we're going to put people back out into society, if making them more functional, better educated, better able to work a job, better able to deal with responsibilities. But prison is the opposite of that.
Yeah, I'd imagine. Roughly, like what percentage of the cases that you take on result in an exoneration?
So in terms of when I say taking them on, when we've committed to litigation, I would say we win 80% of our cases, and we get hearings on almost every one. And that's changed dramatically in the last 25 years. When I first started this project, we never got hearings. Judges were used to these habeas petitions being filed from prison by inmates, and they just rubber stamp them denied. And as we've been building up credibility and freeing people, and not just me, but all the projects around the United States, all the lawyers who've exonerated people, we've really created a movement that now has a lot of credibility. And they know when an innocence organization signs on to a brief and files it, that means that case has been heavily vetted, because we don't have the resources to just file on cases that we think aren't going to be good. And so judges pay attention to our cases now. The whole conversation around innocence has changed. It's podcasts like this, social media, TV, How to Make a Murder, all these shows and radios has been great, because the general public now understands that this does happen, and judges understand that this happens, and so it's made our work a lot easier.
What's it like? You mentioned the kind of let's say the detrimental effect that prison has on someone's mind, and particularly I'd have to imagine that if you're someone who got falsely convicted, you're probably not the criminal type. And obviously I'm sure criminal types have an easier time in prison because they're surrounded by type of people who kind of speak their own language, so to speak. So what's it like? Because I mean, you've met with some clients over 20 years. Like, what's it like, seeing the change in them over the years? Be it physically, mentally. What's it like for you seeing that?
Yeah, and now that I've known so many, I can really kind of categorize it in terms of what things factor into how psychologically damaged they're going to be when they get out. Like, so for example, you're exactly right that people like my client Ken Marsh, who's a middle-class white guy who got wrongfully convicted of killing a baby that had actually fallen off a couch, he had nobody to protect him in prison. He can't fall in with any prison gangs. He's got no affiliation with anything, and he's in there for killing a baby, which is the lowest of the low. So he's just going to get killed. So what had to happen to him? He had to be locked up in protective custody, and so he was basically in solitaire the whole time he was in for 20 years. So when I got him out, like, he couldn't even cross the street without me holding his hand. He had nonstop panic attacks, and he had a tremendous difficulties in adjusting. He's doing okay now, but he's been out now like 20 years, and he's got his life back together. Other clients who've been able to stay on the main line, which in prison means general population, they've been able to take classes, they've been able to go to work in a prison, that have had some normalcy going on, have done better. Those that have had contact with family members have done better. But in California, a lot of times our prisons are out in the middle of nowhere, and they come from poor families in LA, and they don't have a car that can drive across the desert 300 miles. They don't have money for a motel to stay in so they can get up at 5 in the morning and get on the line. So a lot of them have no contact with families. Obviously, the amount of time they're in prison impacts their psychology, how disconnected they are from technology. All my clients struggle with technology. It's just, they've never been on the internet. And just imagine, you've never been on the internet, and now all of a sudden everything in life requires the internet, requires a smartphone. My client, Mike Hanlon, I told you about, 36 years, he was an auto mechanic. And he came out and he looked at his first car and he said, "What is this? It's a computer." And he couldn't work on cars. So, I mean, I could literally talk on this topic for 12 hours. I won't, but it's dramatically different client to client of how they're going to adjust back into the real world, but they all struggle with it. Without a doubt, it's just levels of struggle.
On the note about technology, one of the things that Marty said was when he walked out, when sorry, when he was walking around the street, he thought everyone, he thought people were talking to themselves, but it was these Bluetooth things that he had no clue about. Yeah, it must be crazy to have missed that kind of that window when technology and smartphones and everything came into it. Yeah,
Yeah,
you're almost stuck
you and I
in a
can't.
time capsule in some sense.
Exactly. Actually, it's funny you say that because the one example I give to people, I say, if you watch Austin Powers, I think the best way to describe it is the scene in the movie when he's watching everything that happened while he was frozen. And then it's this one like really poignant scene in a comedy where he's like watching the Berlin Wall fall and all these things that he missed. That is what my clients go through. And if you think about like just when you get a new phone, how when you're first looking at like, where are my apps? So this is different. What, like you got to multiply that by 1,000, by 1,000,000 to get a comprehension of what someone is doing who hasn't been through any of those advances, didn't have a flip phone, didn't never had a smartphone, doesn't understand the internet, all this stuff that becomes intuitive as we've been part of the development of it, they're just lost. And you really can't like pay attention, and everybody listening to this, pay attention the next week of how much stuff in your life requires technology and how many things that you've got to do, and think about if you just had no clue how to do those things, whether you could function in almost any current job in our society and just get along.
Even on a small level, for a while the back camera on my phone was broken, and when I would go to eat places, a lot of places kind of because of COVID, but they needed you to scan a QR, so I actually couldn't I couldn't even I need to like request like a paper menu like an old person. Yeah, it coined the
Exactly. And that's such a tiny, yeah, so one thing like that. Now imagine you go into that restaurant and you don't have a phone because you don't know how to use a phone. And you can't DocuSign anything because you don't even know what the hell that means. And you can't, my client Mike Hanline, he went to sign up for Social Security. He was over 65. They said, you have to sign up when you're 62. And they said, why didn't you do that? And he said, because I was in prison serving a life sentence. I couldn't drop by the Social Security office and sign up. And it's this nonstop barrage of that kind of stuff.
On the note about meeting people throughout their sentence, I suppose it must happen where maybe that 20% of cases that you litigate don't bear fruit. What's it like meeting for someone we meeting with someone for that long and then in the end having to tell them, look, sorry, I couldn't do it for you.
Horrible, just horrible. You never put it down. It ages you. It wears on you. Whenever I talk to groups of people, I always say, what do you think is harder, representing an innocent person or a guilty person? And most people will say they think it's harder to represent a guilty person. And I'll say, you're wrong. Any defense attorney will tell you the hardest person to represent is an innocent person. Because if you're representing a guilty person, you go in there, you do the best job you can, you make the government prove their case, you argue for the best sentence you can, and then you move on. And that's what I did as a trial lawyer when I was, first out of law school. I had a lot of guilty clients and I got the best situation for them I could. But when you've got an innocent case and you can't prove it, you just beat yourself up over it and you never want to put it down and you can't let it go because it's just wrong. Like there should be a way. And you're always thinking there's got to be a way. And that's why in the last 10 years, I've really gotten into clemency arguments in front of governors and I've been successful with a number of them. In fact, 10 years ago, next month, I did a crazy thing, which is I walked from San Diego to Sacramento, 712 miles, and carried clemency petitions to make a big production out of we're not paying attention to these cases and turned it into this crazy media story of, why is this law professor walking across the state? And we got 10 of those 12 clemency petitions. We've ended up getting those people out of prison. But,
I'm sorry to cut in. Can you remind me what clemency is? I'm not quite sure.
So the governor of, well, first of all, it started in Britain. The Queen, or now the King, has always had power to release anyone from prison. It was always called the royal prerogative. And no matter what the justice system did, they could come in and wave a magic wand, you're out. Well, we brought that to the colonies and put it in our Constitution, and the president can free anybody the president wants from federal prison, and every governor has the power to do that in their state prison system. And it's kind of a fail safe, where if the system fails, they can come in and fix it. And California, our current governor, Gavin Newsom, has granted a number of these. He's granted to four of our clients clemency. And we go in and make these arguments in front of the governor of saying, the system got this wrong. This is an innocent person. They're difficult to get. It's highly political. You need to have brave governors who are going to stand up against right-wing conservatives who will call them soft on crime, even when it's an innocent person. But it's another way to get innocent people out of prison when everything else fails.
Some states in this country have the death penalty. When I think about it, I think for like certain crimes, if the more extreme ones, like maybe the murders and pedophilia, etc., I can I could I even myself I could make a very strong case for the death penalty in cases like that. But the big for me at least anyway, the big roadblock for that argument is cases where an innocent person is convicted. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, you've worked on it for so
Lots of
long.
thoughts.
Tell me what you think. Should there be a death penalty at all? And
Well, here's the way I want you to think about it. To me, it's not about whether these people deserve to die. I think people get very focused on that. And I can't make an argument whether someone deserves to die or not. But I certainly see people's argument of saying, well, this person doesn't deserve to live. I get that. The
And
problem is,
sorry to cut in, and the fact that like the taxpayer is going to have to pay for them to live for the rest of their life.
well,
That too.
actually, under our system, it costs more to execute someone, but I'll tell you why that is in a minute. So for me, it's not whether they deserve to die, it's whether we deserve to kill. And Marilyn Molero, my client, was the 190th innocent person to be walked off death row after finding they're innocent. And those are the lucky ones where there was still evidence that existed. They got lawyers to take on their case. They got judges to grant hearings. They got judges to reverse their death sentences, which is not easy to do. We've done that 190 times now. Now, if a system is making mistakes at that level, I don't think that system is entitled to have that kind of power. So for me, the conversation ends there. It's not about whether they're horrible people, whether they deserve to die. Many of them, let's say they do. And there's no value in that. But that's a problem. The second problem beyond innocence is when you look at statistics, there's so much racism in that system. It's outrageous. It's not the people who do the worst crimes who get the death penalty, it's people who kill white victims. And the statistics just pan that out. It's when you're killing people of color, it's rarely a death case. When you kill white people, it becomes more likely a death case because of all the politics and all the pressure around those kinds of cases. In terms of cost, I actually wrote a law review article on this topic called How Can We Sleep? No, what is it? It's about, I wrote it 20 years ago. It's about the cost of introducing the death penalty. And at the time, I was living in Michigan and they were thinking about having a death penalty. And statistically, because you have to have an appellate process with the death penalty to make it constitutional, that process is so lengthy and death penalty trials are so expensive. And remember, go back to what I said before, 95% of cases plead out, but death cases go to trial. And those trials can cost $2 million with all the expenses of experts and court time and lawyers and everything accorded to it. That actually sending someone to prison for the rest of their life is cheaper than having a death penalty trial. And then you have not only the trial expenses, now you got the death penalty expenses, now you got the housing on death row, which is the most expensive housing because it's single cell, high security. And so when you look closely at the numbers, it's actually cheaper to keep people in prison for their life than to execute them. And there's no way to
Really?
change that and still have it be constitutional.
Really, that's interesting.
But most politicians won't tell you that because it takes 10 minutes to explain it. And they gotta have a 30-second TV commercial. So they just say, bad person, kill them. And the public gets that.
Right. You mentioned I think you mentioned a bit of work you did in Mexico. On that note, have you done would say innocent false conviction based work in many countries? And if yes, how does the US compare? Like would you rather be someone on trial for something you didn't do in America or some other country?
Yeah, so I spent about a third of my time in Latin America. I've helped start 30 innocence organizations in Mexico, Central America, South America, all over Latin America. I've worked in Europe. I spend every summer I'm in London teaching a course on wrongful convictions and working with the London Innocence Project. I've been to Asia. We have Asian projects. I've seen the work all around the world. Is the United States the worst justice system in the world? No. Is it the best? No. We are a middling system, is the way I would say. If I'm going to be on trial, I want to be in Northern Europe without a doubt. They put far more resources into the cases. There's a system that's based on rehabilitation, so they have a lowest recidivism rate in the world, and that allows them to have more resources to focus on the cases, and they do a great job. I did a trial. I had a client in a case in Qatar in the Middle East. That is somewhere I would not want to go again, because how bad that system is. It was just a case purely based on racism, where my clients almost got the death penalty for the death of their child who died of a sickness. And it was just a ridiculous case. In Latin America, we got our struggles. I trained the first 12 public defenders after the fall of Pinochet in Chile 25 years ago. And now Chile has one of the best systems in Latin America. They have some things that I think we could introduce in the States. And it's interesting to see why, because they had a totalitarian regime. The general public became so untrusting of the government that when they rebuilt their justice system, they had things like, well, you can't do undercover investigation. You need to inform people they're being investigated, because they had a real, fear of their government and having too much power. And the United States, we've never gone through that. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who don't trust the government, but we've never lost complete faith in our government. And so we haven't had those kind of radical reforms. We're seeing some of them now. I think the Black Lives Matter movement is the most significant movement in criminal justice I've ever seen. Millions of young white kids out in the street protesting for Black lives. We've seen Colorado recently reform their system, and now police officers don't have immunity anymore in Colorado against lawsuits. So I think we're going to see some reforms. So I have some faith, that we can make this system a lot better, but the idea that we have the best system in the world is just, it's kind of typical nationalistic nonsense that you hear about a lot of things from people who've never traveled around the world and don't really know how things. Like when people tell me the United States is the freest country in the world, I'm just saying, like, where have you been? We have more regulations in this country. You can't, parking regulations. Anytime you build anything, you got a million regulations. Like, there's countries that have a lot
The
more
percentage
freedom.
of people in prison, even. Yeah, the percentage of the population.
We have the highest percentage of our population in prison in any country in the world. And the other thing, you think about that against the backdrop that we're the richest country in the world. How does the richest country in the world lock up the highest percentage of its population if crime is connected with economics? And the answer is the war on drugs. We've just gone crazy with it and locked up so many of our citizens that we're now number one in the world. And that makes no sense.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all your time. Fascinating interview. Seriously, I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it a lot more than most. Is there anything you'd like to leave us on? Any kind of final thoughts or things you wanted to add?
Well, I'd love people to check out my book called You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. It's available on Amazon. It's available on all the websites and bookstores. And it's really a summation of what I've learned in 32 years of doing this work. If people want to hear my daily rants, they can follow me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Justin O. Brooks. And it's a pleasure talking to you.
Very good. Thanks again for your time. Very much appreciate it. And best of luck with the book and all the work you do in the future. And I'm sure there's people in prison right now, who you'll be walking out or will be walking out because.